Hi, I'm Robert Schuler.
And I'm Donna Schuler.
And Donna and I are interviewing a dear friend of ours. We've known him for many, many years. His name is Calvin Mount. And I think we first met Calvin through my son, Anthony.
For sure.
Donna's going, for sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Calvin, is that your memory?
Yes, yeah.
So how did you and Anthony meet?
I met Anthony through Young Life. If I remember correctly, it was one of the Young Life meetings down in Capo Beach at, I don't remember whose house it was,
mm-hmm.
but it was Young Life, and then we ended up hanging out a bit more and more, and then we became really close when we went on the Young Life retreat out in Arizona.
That's right. And then we started Young Life in our house in Laguna Beach because there wasn't a Young Life. Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. I do.
That was a long time ago. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I was just looking at the night that we started the Young Life, downstairs where we kind of called it Anthony's section of the house, right, in Laguna.
Yeah.
There was a double rainbow over the ocean. I don't know if you remember that night, and I have a picture of it.
Uh-huh.
That was the first Young Life thing we did there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was it was a good sign that we were doing the right thing.
So you're engaged now, right?
I am engaged. Married on April 15th.
Oh, April 15th. That's coming quick.
That's why you were busy today, hauling stuff in, right?
Man.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah,
busy,
congratulations.
Really busy. Thank you.
Well, thanks. That's, we're even more honored that you're talking to us just this close.
Yeah, really? that's exciting. So 10 years ago, could you imagine yourself being married and being in this position?
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
So where were you 10 years ago?
10 years ago, I was kind of in the beginning stages of my addiction. I had already drank before and kind of dabbled in a few things, but about 10 years ago would bring it back to probably around my senior year of high school, and that's when I started getting more, I guess, rooted in the crowd of people I was hanging out with. That were, you know, as told by my parents, not people I should be hanging out with. The bad kids at school or whatever that generally got into drugs, and we all fed off of each other doing that, and it just sort of led to deeper and deeper into the addiction.
Where did you, remind me where you went to school? I know it was in South Orange County. I just can't remember what.
Dana Hills High School.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Of course, Dana Hills.
Yeah.
Yep. And Anthony went to Laguna Beach, of course. I think that's one of the things we'll talk about a little bit is that, you know, this is not a problem that's like in the Inland Empire. This isn't like in some other state. This is in the affluent areas of Orange County.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a big misconception thinking that money means you got everything together,
mm-hmm.
you know.
That's right.
But what I found was, I mean, it's not a case for everyone, obviously, but mm-hmm. What I found was because we did come into an area where it's like on the outside may look like everyone's got their, you know, got their lives together. They got lots of money. They live generally lavish lifestyles in comparison to the rest of the world and parts
right.
of the U.S., whatever it may be, you're able to kind of hide behind that facade, I guess you could say. And with that, I mean, there's a lot of time on our hands down here. It wasn't really, I mean, looking back, there's a lot to do here.
Yeah, there's a lot to do.
At the time, I was like, oh, I can't do it. There's nothing to do here. This is boring. And then, you know, everyone has their money or mom and dad's credit card or whatever it may be. And we would, you know, the boredom and, you know, as it says, like idle hands are, you know, the devil's playground,
right.
you know, and it's
right.
It's very true. You know, we would sit around, be bored and you know, being bored on drugs is better than being bored and not, you know. And, you know, and it kind of progressed from there. And then, you know, it took over our lives a lot quicker than any of us could have anticipated. And it was.
So what was your low point, Cal?
Oh, I had a lot of low points.
what does it look like?
Well, so I would get a little bit of clean time together, and then I would fall back into my old ways and get a little bit of clean time together, and then fall back into my old ways. It seemed to be a recurring kind of revolving door type of thing, and it was like I said, like once you get into that lifestyle and doing that, it's so hard to get out of. But I mean, my lowest point, I was at school, I was doing good, and then I ended up, I had a surgery done where I got put on pain medication, and I followed it according to the doctor. But the thing was, because of my heroin use, for however long it was at that point, the pills didn't do anything for me, and I was in like a severe amount of pain, and I knew what would take the pain away. So I ended up getting back into it, and I went on a very long run, and I ended up overdosing in the dorm room. I think you probably remember this.
Yes, I do.
At Vanguard, sadly, and I ended up, I stopped breathing for 10 minutes. The paramedics were pretty much ready to tag me and bag me. And luckily, thank God, that one of the paramedics, I think he was a younger guy, if I remember correctly. I mean, I was really out of it, but if I remember correctly, it was a younger guy. And he was like, why don't we try another shot at Narcan? This is what they were telling me after I came out of my overdose. And they decided, okay, well, let's try another one. You know, it's not going to cost them anything. So they gave me a second shot of Narcan, which normally, one, you come whipping out of it, like, wide awake, ready to, like, super alert and, like, overly alert. And they gave me a second one, and it was enough to bring me back to, like, a state that they could essentially save me.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, they took me to the hospital, and I don't really remember the ride to the hospital. And I just remember waking up in the hospital, and I was hooked up to all the tubes, monitors, wires, and I was handcuffed to the bed. And I was there for a little bit, and there's a cop standing next to me, and my parents came. I saw them come in to the hospital, and my mom and dad were just both in tears. And that was a very low point, but I think the thing that got to me the most, or like that made me realize that it was such a low point, is I was so deep in my addiction at the time that the only thing I could think of was, when can I get out of here? I need to get more.
Mm-hmm.
And to, like, thinking back to that day and like my mindset back then, to even think of that is just, it's mind-blowing to me that I was able to really believe that, you know, that I needed to, like, get out of there and get high after what just happened, you know?
So you had that, it sounds like you had that, I mean, obviously there's an emotional, psychological addiction there, but it sounds like you had the physical addiction, too. So,
oh, yeah, it was very
craving, going, okay, you've saved my life.
Now I got to go get
some
more.
Now I got to go do it. I have a question, because you talked about, and I think this is an important thing for the people that will be listening to this podcast to know, so that we can reiterate this, that you were talking about prescription medicine. And, you know, there's a misconception out there, too, that people that do drugs are doing illegal drugs. And surely it leads to that sometimes and most times, but you mentioned prescriptions, so maybe you can just talk a little bit about, I don't know, maybe like where your journey began. Like, was it pot, and then were you one of the kids that found the prescription medicine, or did you?
Did
that happen?
So I started actually from drinking. That was kind of my lead into that kind of realm of life, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. As much people say, like, marijuana is the gateway drug, I don't really believe that necessarily. I believe that alcohol is, because mm-hmm. alcohol is so acceptable in society.
Yes.
I mean, you can go to anywhere. I mean, you can go to a gas station, liquor store, grocery store. I mean, you go most anywhere and you can buy alcohol.
That's
and it's not frowned upon, you know, even if you're a really heavy drinker or an alcoholic drinker, people are, oh, he just drinks a lot, you know, and it's so just swept under the rug and just mm-hmm. put to the wayside. And, you know, that's how I got my start into that. So I started hanging
out.
How
old were you then when you started drinking?
Oh, well, I mean, as you know, my parents are from Ireland, and when I would go back there, like over there, it's not unusual to drink at a really young age.
Right.
So I started drinking at like probably 9 or 10. But like it wasn't like I wasn't throwing back vodka. So it was like
right.
I'd have a beer with my relatives and stuff like that.
Or part of the culture.
Exactly. It is the culture there. It really is. So to say that I was drinking by myself at 9 or 10 years old is not the picture I'm trying to paint.
Right, right. No, we get it.
Yeah, but like party type drinking, I started doing that probably my freshman year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
So like 14, 15,
mm-hmm.
I would say is like when I was doing that party type of drinking, I guess you could say, that led to that kind of lifestyle of drinking, drugs, and, you know, all that, the sinful stuff.
mm-hmm.
And,
You're going to Young Life, and you're going to other activities during this time. Did your Christian activity have any impact upon your recovery, you think?
Okay, so, yeah, it was always a battle for me. Because I grew up, I grew up in a great family. I was very privileged as a kid. I was definitely, you know, well off, and it wasn't like I came from a broken home or any of that at all. It was, I grew up in a Christian household, and I think having that kind of helped in recovery. But I've found, for my personal testimony, that the more I would try to embed myself in the Lord and try and get in with that, the devil tries even harder to bring you back to his side. And I don't know if it was like me being weak or my willpower not being there, whatever it may be, I ended up falling back into the temptation. And it was like every time I would like get really rooted in God and getting back into that, the devil would slowly keep pulling away at me again, and it would I ended up falling back into temptation and so on and so forth until this last time around when I got clean, and I basically just completely devoted my life to God and saying like essentially what they say when you get clean is having the urge to use to be lifted. And that's what I got to the point where I was in rehab for, I think it was 2 weeks at the time. And this was like my 8th rehab I'd been to. And this was the last time around. I after 2 weeks in, I was still craving to use so badly. And I wanted to get clean so badly too at the same time. Which is like, there's nothing worse in your life than being so torn between two complete opposites. And I got on my knees one night and I was like, God, you need to remove this obsession to use, or I'm going to go back out again. Like, there's no way I can go through life like this every day. Like, it's just not possible.
Wow.
And I went to sleep and I woke up the next morning and I didn't want to use. As cheesy as
wow.
that sounds, like it really, and I haven't wanted to use drugs since then.
Sounds like a miracle. It actually sounds.
It really is. It really is. And as cheesy and corny as it may sound, like it is so true. And, you know, basically I give it up to God, and it's without him, I wouldn't be here today. And after living through all the stuff that I had lived through, I mean, clearly there was plenty of times my life could have been taken. I went into just one of them, but, you know, obviously God's got me here for some reason, and it
you
wasn't
bet.
My time then.
You
so.
Bet. And I had a couple questions. So when you said you'd been in rehab like 8 times.
Yeah, I went to 8 different facilities. Well, not different facilities, but yeah.
And I know that's quite common, that people, you know, you just fall back. You try to...
Yeah, because a lot of people think, a lot of people believe that, oh, well, it was put in a newspaper however many years ago that you need to go to rehab and it's 28-day program and you need 28 days and you'll be good and you'll be on your feet. And, you know, that for some reason, it's 28 days or a month, they would say. And I think it also comes down to the fact that a lot of insurances only cover 28 days of in-house rehab.
Right.
And they couldn't be more wrong.
That's
28
right.
days is when you finally got the fog is kind of lifted out of your brain. You're able to kind of think a bit more rationally somewhat. And you have no life skills at all whatsoever. I mean, you're out using drugs daily, all day, generally. I mean, not everybody is, but most people that are going to be going into rehab are. And, I mean, you're like a baby when you come out of rehab after 28 days. I had no clue what I was doing, you know?
Exactly.
And the only time, the only reason the 8th time at rehab worked is because after I had that obsession lifted, I told my parents I want to stay and do the 90-day program,
mm-hmm.
and that is what made the biggest difference for me, was staying the full 90 days, and you actually learn life skills there, and this goes for any rehab facility. You're going to learn these skills that basically gets you back on your feet and into life again and into like a functioning human in society.
That is cool. So you know why these questions are so important to hear, like straight out of your mouth to us, is because I told you before we really began, you know, recording the call for the podcast tonight, that one of our big goals in our ministry now, Robert and I, we started in recovery ministry almost 25 years ago, believe it or not, and then... Yeah, we did all kinds of things at Rancho Capistrano. Robert actually wrote a book on the 12 steps that came out 23 years ago. And then, you know, God had different plans for us, and he pulled us here and he pulled us there. And we've done all kinds of things in ministry, of course.
Yeah.
But now it's sort of like we're coming full circle. And one of the things we really, really want to see happen is we want to see as many people as we can possibly get off the streets, out of their addictions, and into 90-day programs, and then into longer-term transitional living so that, like you've already sort of alluded to, you know, it's not like you just go into treatment for 28 days or, you know.
Yeah, you're not magically
for a month
better.
And then come back and live, right, and go hang out with your same buddies, your same friends, go to the same parties, and think that you can resist that. You need to learn new, right, life skills. You need to be completely rehabilitated. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this just makes, I mean, I don't know about you, Robert, but I'm sure it just makes me feel like we're on the right track.
Well, 100%.
Yeah, we just...
yeah, I definitely agree that you guys are on the right track, 100% for sure. I think that the 90 days... Oh, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, after your 90 days, did you move in with your parents? Did you have some kind of a transitional living?
I had a sober living, and to be honest, I think... I mean, obviously, I got my foundation of recovery in rehab, but I think it was the sober living that really saved me. Not just from not using.
I've heard that a lot.
Learning how to live again. Like, because in a sober living, they teach you responsibility, being accountable, and you keep your other roommates accountable there.
Wow.
And it's such a huge thing I think people overlook. And I think also, too, what it is a lot of people don't do it because people charge a lot of money for sober
right.
livings. And that's why I want to start my own sober living. I was kind of talking to you guys a little bit before this
that's
about
awesome.
That. And I've been wanting to open up one for a few years now. I'm just trying to figure out, like, I guess the financials and all that kind of stuff to it. But I want to make one that's affordable because, for the most part, most people that are out on the streets using drugs don't have a ton of money.
Right.
Don't have any
you know?
Money.
Yeah, some don't
They're
have
minus.
Any. So how are they going to give themselves the treatment and the help that they need? Yeah, they may have family
exactly.
members that need help, but they're going to get cut off at some point. And I think that's the problem is the sober livings are so expensive and it's so overlooked because of that. And they're like, oh, well, you can just go live back at our place or you can go live wherever.
Mm-hmm.
The sober living, it's a foundation it's so necessary that it teaches you, like I said, accountability, responsibility, and you learn how to, like, take care of a house again, like do simple
mm-hmm.
things that you've probably completely already forgotten, like taking trash out, cleaning the, you know, vacuuming and grocery shopping. And
right.
they make you go out, like, after a certain amount of time that you have to start looking for a job and you need to, you know, you have certain kind of levels you go by and everyone has a certain chore and everyone keeps each other accountable for their chores. And you learn how to, like, be a functioning human society again. And that's why I'd like to start one myself and make it affordable for people, you know.
How long were you in sober living?
I did it for, if I remember, it was a little while back, so I'm trying to remember here. It was, I want to say, at least 3 months. So I had, by the time I was done with my foundation work in getting clean, I had 6 months, you know. So by then, the fog's pretty much gone. You're able to think clearly. You're more responsible. You're able to handle your emotions much better, which I think is a huge thing because you've been numbing down your emotions for however many years you've been using, and all of a sudden all these emotions are coming out that you didn't even know you had, and sometimes it's really overwhelming, so you've kind of got more of a control over it after that time. And, you know, like I said, it's such a huge thing that's overlooked in recovery, is sober living.
That's amazing. You know, I have a friend, and one of our friends, and it's part of our gathering down in Mexico. You know, we spend quite a few Sundays down there, and we lead a little gathering, but she's a recovered alcoholic. And she said to me one day, she said, Donna, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a thinking problem. It's in my mind. It's the way
yeah.
I look at things and the way I live my life. And I really thought long and hard about that. She said, yep, she has a thinking problem. She goes, it's not the alcohol. That's not my problem, you know, avoiding that. I can avoid it.
Yeah,
it's just when my mind starts getting
yeah.
all messed up, right? So it's kind of like what you were saying in a way. I guess I, you know, so that we can wrap this up, we're going to have a prayer and we're going to close. But what I'm thinking as far as the question is, like, if there's somebody listening to this when this goes to podcast, when it's broadcasting, you know how those are. They're out there forever and ever. And
yeah.
we get people, you know, that contact us about all kinds of different interviews we've done. But what is maybe if there's a parent out there that, or a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or maybe a best friend listening to this tonight and they're, like, thinking, oh, no, it couldn't be my friend or it can't be my son or my daughter. I mean, is there, like, something – is there,
good
like,
question.
Something that you could – like, is there, like, a word of knowledge, I guess, or some sort of advice, just, like, a little teeny snippet of advice that you could give if there's somebody that once this goes to, you know, that's online that – thinks, oh, yeah, I think it might be my high school daughter, but she's a straight-A student. This would never happen to her. Or we give her everything she could possibly want. She can't be on drugs. What, you know, what can you say to that?
I mean, it can happen to anyone. And it doesn't mean you're a bad parent. It doesn't mean you're a bad friend by any means. It really comes down to what who your son and daughter have surrounded themselves with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tempting world out there, and it's hard to not give in to temptation. And it's it's one of those things, it can happen to anyone, and nobody wants to believe that their son or daughter or their best friend is using drugs or drinking, but I don't believe it's something that people need to necessarily be ashamed of. I've really accepted the fact of what I've done, and I, to be quite honest, wouldn't change anything. It's molded me and shaped me to be the person I am today, and I think I'm a stronger and better person than I ever could have been because of I've been through. So it's not something to be ashamed of. So, like, if you do have a son or daughter that is having issues and you just keep denying it or you think it's not them, it couldn't be, it's not something to be ashamed of and to blame yourself for. I don't blame my parents one bit for what I did. It was not their fault. Like I said, I was raised in an amazing household. I was given everything I needed and everything that I possibly could have wanted growing up. And it was simply, I had an addictive gene, and it is a problem. Like, it is an actual scientifically proven disease of the mind. Like we were just saying, it's a disease of the mind. It's not alcohol. Alcohol is not my problem. It's the way I think and do things is what's wrong. And you can see it, not just, like, a lot of people may never touch drugs or alcohol in their life, but they are an addict. Like, the work or working out or addicted to video games or whatever it may be. There's so many things you can be addicted to. And it depends on how desperate and where it takes you in life and how unmanageable your life becomes. And like I said, it can happen to anyone.
And it does happen to a lot of people.
It happens to a lot of people.
How long have you been clean now?
I've been clean for a year and a half now.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I had a little slip up, but I haven't touched hard drugs in over 4 years, but I thought I could drink again. I quickly realized that, like, because I thought that wasn't my problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried, you know, drinking a little bit here and there, and quickly realized, you know what, it doesn't feel right. So I felt that it was right to start my time over and be completely sober, I guess you could say.
It's
year and a half, yeah.
That's awesome. Good for you. Well, I know that I think I came across you, Cal, and I remember I texted you that day. It's been a couple of years ago now that you were on that. Were you on that movie, either Behind the Orange Curtain or one of those?
I was on Overtaken.
Overtaken, yes. And I saw you and I saw your testimony. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm so proud of Cal. I can't believe it. I texted you. That was a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, I think, when you had all your recovery from your hard drugs and all. And I am. I'm so proud of you. And I know you have an amazing career. You're a barber, and you have a great business. And I know you're getting married, and you're going to be raising your own kids one day. And I'm telling you, you're going to use all of this knowledge.
Exactly.
And you're going to be an outstanding parent. And like you said, I mean, you wouldn't trade anything. And I think most of us that have been through something really tough like this in their life realize that this is part of what makes us who we are, and we're human. You know, we're not God, we're not Jesus, we're not perfect. We just look to somebody who is, and that's Jesus, and we fall and we make mistakes, so we pick ourselves back up and we come better and stronger people for it. And I thank you for being such a good testimony, such a good witness for the power of Jesus and the power of God and what he can do. Jesus can do miracles, and people forget that. You know, there are such things as miracles, and I know we're all so surprised when he does what he promises he's going to do.
Right? Wow, he did it.
Our human brain just can't wrap we can't wrap our minds around it, and yet there are miracles all around us. And I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful that you're Anthony's friend and that you're getting married and that your life is on track. And I'm going to let Robert pray, and then we'll say goodbye.
Yeah, we want to have a prayer for you, Kel.
All right. Dear
Heavenly Father, we thank you. What's your fiance's name?
Carly.
Carly. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that you're a great and wonderful God who performs miracles in so many wonderful, beautiful ways. And so we thank you for the miracle of love, of bringing Cal and Carly together. Continue to just support them through this time as they prepare for their wedding. Be with Cal as he continues to look for ways to help people in sober living, and be with their families as they make this transition from girlfriend and boyfriend to husband and wife. And so just continue to reveal your blessings to them today and tomorrow and always. We love you, Lord. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, Cal. And I'll send you a link once this gets up on a podcast, okay?
All right, perfect. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Hey, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, good night. Bye.